Simon & Schuster Audio presents This Will Not Pass, Trump, Biden, and the Battle for America's Future by Jonathan Martin and Alexander Burns. Read by Dennis Boutsikaris.
A Note to Readers. This book is based on hundreds of interviews with people at every level of government in Washington, scores of American states and cities, and several foreign capitals. These interviews were conducted on a range of terms. Some people agreed to speak on the record, meaning that they could be cited by name, while others insisted on some degree of anonymity in order to share the most sensitive elements of their experiences in this time of crisis. Some sources relayed confidential documents to confirm or expand upon their recollections. Others shared audio or videotapes taken at crucial times, including recordings of private meetings with White House officials and congressional leaders. These materials represent a crucial contribution to the historical record, allowing the authors to narrate some of the most important and disturbing moments of this period in thorough detail. Where quotations are attributed directly to individuals, it is because they reflect the verbatim language used in interviews, text messages, emails, documents, or in recorded material, or were relayed by authoritative sources soon after the fact. In other situations, this book renders conversations and scenes in paraphrased form. Interviews for this book are quoted in the present tense to reflect that the speaker was looking back on events from a distance. Conversations and remarks that unfolded in real time are quoted in the past tense. In every instance, the authors have endeavored to tell the story of these tumultuous years in our history as vividly as possible, and with the highest degree of precision and fidelity to the facts. Introduction. A Recognizable Target. Abigail Spanberger and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez were not close friends. Though they both claimed House seats in 2018, an election year that elevated a vanguard of Democratic women, the two had little in common. Spanberger had been an operative with the Central Intelligence Agency before running for the House as a down-the-middle centrist in the red-tinted suburbs of Richmond, Virginia. Ocasio-Cortez, a decade her junior, was an organizer on the 2016 Bernie Sanders campaign and then defeated an incumbent member of the Democratic leadership, campaigning as a socialist in New York City. In some respects, the two women represented the enormous gulf within the Democratic Party, separating the young left-wingers who made up the party's grassroots from the moderate suburban constituencies whose votes had delivered Democrats a majority in the House in 2018 and then elected Joe Biden to the presidency. But in the first days of 2021, Spanberger and Ocasio-Cortez were not thinking much about their differences. Spanberger placed a call to her colleague on a more urgent subject. In just a few days, Congress would be tasked with certifying the results of the 2020 election. In a normal year, it was a pro forma exercise. The popular vote had already been tallied, and the Electoral College had carried out its arcane duties in the middle of December. The role of the House and Senate was mostly ornamental. Things were shaping up differently this year. President Donald Trump had refused to concede the election, and he had instead spent the two previous months peddling increasingly outlandish conspiracy theories about election fraud. His complaints were ungrounded in fact, and lawsuits brought on his behalf had been all but laughed out of court. But many of his followers had bought into Trump's claims, and a good number of them were planning to gather in Washington for a demonstration outside the Capitol on January 6th. The president was clinging to a bogus theory that his obsequious vice president, Mike Pence, could use his status as the presiding officer in the Senate to block certification of the election. As a former intelligence officer, Spanberger was concerned about the possibility of violence, particularly violence targeting her fellow Democrats, and most especially, the handful of highly recognizable progressive women who had been demonized by the right. She reached out to Ocasio-Cortez to urge her to take some unusual precautions, counseling an American lawmaker to approach the physical space of the Capitol and the ritual of certifying a free and fair election with the same caution she may have used with an intelligence asset in a dangerous foreign country. "You are a very recognizable target," Spanberger recalls telling Ocasio-Cortez. "Drive to work and make sure that you dress in a way where you are as less recognizable as you could possibly be. Wear sneakers, dress down, don't look like you." That extraordinary conversation was one of many rippling through Congress in those tense days before January 6th. In the aftermath of the insurrection, it would become clear that the national security apparatus of the United States and the police leaders responsible for defending the Capitol had failed to anticipate and prepare for the scale of the threat at hand. But to the lawmakers charged with completing the transfer of power between presidents, the mood of menace was pervasive. To them, it was apparent enough that the basic institutions of American democracy had been strained almost to the breaking point. In late December, Maxine Waters, the senior Democrat from Los Angeles, had spoken up on a video call with other lawmakers to inquire about security measures for January 6th. Waters, one of the most recognizable black women in Congress and a frequent target of the conservative media, was alarmed about one far-right organization in particular. In the first presidential debate, Trump had pointedly declined to denounce the extremist group known as the Proud Boys. "Stand back and stand by," he told them. And now, some of its members appeared to be headed to Washington. What, Waters asked, is being done about that? On January 3rd, Democratic leaders issued guidance to lawmakers on keeping a low profile. Worried about a potential altercation with pro-Trump demonstrators on January 6th, they advised the rank and file to conceal the special pins that identified them as members of Congress and to use a network of tunnels that runs under the Capitol to move around that day, rather than going outside. Lauren Underwood, a young lawmaker from Illinois, later paraphrased the safety advice with frustrated sarcasm, "It'll be fine, but in case you're worried, just take the tunnel." Andy Kim, a House Democrat from New Jersey, had intended to bring his wife and two sons down to Washington to see him sworn in for a second term. A former National Security Council official who had worked in Afghanistan, Kim and his wife, Cammie, decided to err on the side of caution. "I told her, you know, I'm a little concerned about some of the chatter that we're hearing about this protest," Kim says. "So, I mean, I want you and the kids to stay up in Jersey." Before Kim returned to Washington alone, his wife said goodbye with a message Kim did not recall her giving him at any other time. "Her last words to me were, 'Be careful,'" he says. Another Democrat, Jason Crow of Colorado, had brought his family to the nation's capital for his swearing-in and had hoped they would stay until January 7th, the day after Congress would certify Biden's victory and drop the curtain on the Trump era. But those plans changed. A former Army Ranger who did three tours in Afghanistan and Iraq, Crow says he sent his family home on the eve of the certification vote. "My wife and I made the decision for them to leave on the 5th, which they did for safety," he says. Crow is not the only veteran of America's 21st century wars to recognize an incipient breakdown in political order. The previous summer, Mikey Sherrill of New Jersey, who flew helicopters in the Navy before winning a wealthy suburban district in 2018, had pressed the country's top general to confirm that the armed forces would not be used to thwart an orderly transition from one president to the next. The Trump administration had used the military in a brazen political stunt in early June, when the president marched through Lafayette Park to brandish a Bible outside St. John's Church, flanked during the short walk by the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley. Both men had expressed regret afterward, but Sherrill was deeply dismayed. Concerned that the armed forces could be used in even more sinister ways, she pressed Milley by phone to commit that there would not be some sort of military coup. "He assured me in private that he understood his constitutional duties, as did our military," Sherrill says, "and he felt very secure that the military would carry out its constitutional duties." But as the certification vote rapidly approached, questions of military neutrality and public order were looming as large as ever. Milley, an Army general whose relationship with the president was in tatters, was among those broaching exceptionally delicate subjects in preparation for the long day ahead. On January 4th, the general placed a call to Tom Cotton, the Republican senator from Arkansas. A hard-line conservative and a close ally of the president, Cotton had announced he would vote to certify the election results, and he was working closely with Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, to counter a group of senators who intended to object. Milley had taken note of Cotton's statement and reached out to ask for help. "Could you explain," he asked Cotton, "how the certification process on January 6th is supposed to work?" He was worried, the general explained, that Washington was poised to explode. It was not that he feared an insurrection exactly, but Milley had seen the scenes of violence in American streets the previous summer, and he feared that in a tinderbox environment, there could be an outbreak of street violence between extreme forces on the right and left. That turned out to be a fatally misguided read on the threat at hand. Even House Republicans were alarmed. On the eve of the vote, the GOP conference gathered in the Capitol Visitor Center to debate how they should handle the process, with some members beaming in remotely. It was obvious that a large number of conservatives would vote to object to the election results, some of them out of an earnest belief in election fraud conspiracies, but most out of fear that doing the opposite would bring down the wrath of President Trump and his MAGA army. A small few acknowledged that fear openly and fretted about the implications of indulging a paranoid horde. "Those people coming to D.C. in droves, praying that tomorrow we are going to overturn the election and make Donald Trump the president for 4 more years? Are we going to satisfy those concerns with what we do tomorrow?" asked Mike Gallagher, a young Marine veteran representing Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District. "How long," Gallagher demanded to know, "are we prepared to tell these people that the election is not over?" Debbie Lesko of Arizona, a pro-Trump conservative, said she had asked House leaders to come up with a safety plan, because there could be hundreds of thousands of people pouring into Washington. Expressing fear about the left-wing group Antifa, she wondered aloud, should members get special transportation or police escorts back to their homes? But Lesko wasn't just musing about threats from the far left. "We also have, quite honestly, Trump supporters who actually believe that we are going to overturn the election," she said. "And when that does not happen, most likely will not happen, they are going to go nuts." Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader, assured Lesko that he was in touch with the sergeant-at-arms and they're preparing ahead of time on the security front. A conciliatory character by nature, far more of a cheerleader than an arm twister, as congressional leaders go, McCarthy had forged a tight political alliance with Trump, and he was eager not to let the certification debate strain that bond or divide the GOP conference. "I do not judge anybody on how they vote," he said in wrapping up the tense discussion, adding, "what I'd like to do is get through tomorrow." On the day of the certification vote, the potential for violence was so clear that Brendan Boyle, a House Democrat from Philadelphia, heard from some labor union leaders back home with an unusual offer. The officials with the building trades, including associates of the longtime boss John "Johnny Doc" Doherty, had followed the news reports suggesting things could get rough on January 6th. Would it be helpful to Boyle, they wondered, if they sent down some of their guys to be by his side? To the whole assortment of lawmakers and office holders bracing for the worst on January 6th, or what they imagined might be the worst, there was no real debate about the immediate cause of the threat of violence. There were larger forces in American politics swirling around that date, great currents of social division and cultural change, of decaying trust in shared institutions, and eroding confidence in the democratic process. But those forces had converged on January 6th for a reason, and Adam Smith, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, knew what it was. A matter-of-fact moderate from Washington State with close ties to the nation's military establishment, Smith had told his fellow Democrats he believed there was zero chance of a coup, in part because Trump seemed to lack the intellectual wattage and administrative wherewithal to carry one out. In Smith's reckoning, the president was far more interested in branding his new shiny Space Force and repainting Air Force One than in drawing up plans for an American junta. "After all," Smith says of Trump, "my perception is, he is a fucking moron." Smith says he discouraged his colleagues from even speculating publicly about the concept of a military takeover, lest anxious Democrats inadvertently supply the dim president with inspiration for a crazy plan he did not already have. Still, the Armed Services Committee chairman had spoken numerous times with military leaders about how they might handle things if Trump tested the limits of his powers as commander-in-chief. Mark Milley had told Smith that he knew he did not have to follow illegal orders, a reassuring enough sentiment, should Trump prove more devious than Smith believed him to be. By the early afternoon of that day, the House and Senate had been evacuated with the top leaders of both chambers sequestered at Fort McNair, a waterfront military base in Washington, D.C., and hundreds of other lawmakers locked down in an assortment of Capitol Hill offices and hearing rooms. The evacuation had followed a large and angry rally outside the Capitol, where Trump urged a raucous mass of supporters to fight like hell and demanded that Pence stand up for the good of our Constitution or face Trump's personal repudiation. Taking those words to heart, thousands of Trump supporters had soon overrun the flimsy barricades outside the Capitol complex. The mob included doctors and small business owners, cops and military veterans, seasoned radicals, and angry newcomers to the far-right cause. Some aped the vigilanteism of the Wild West and Jim Crow South, raising a cry, "Hang Mike Pence!" Pence had been plucked from the Senate chamber by the Secret Service and sequestered inside the Capitol. For once defying the president in public, the vice president had refused to indulge Trump's fantasies of blocking the election results, and he had declined to leave. According to Mark Short, Pence's chief of staff, the vice president did not want to create the image of his motorcade fleeing the seat of government in the world's greatest democracy. The exodus from the Senate had been a confusing, hectic affair, with lawmakers, young and old, Democrats and Republicans, ordered hastily away from the chamber by Capitol Police as they struggled to figure out what was going on. Some of them knew that the complex had been breached. Few understood that there was a rampaging mob on their heels. "Do not run, just walk," yelled out a police officer, hoping to stop a senatorial stampede. Patrick Leahy, the Senate's senior Democrat, was rushed toward the tunnels out of the Capitol by a uniformed officer as fast as the 80-year-old Vermonter could walk. Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, a Republican who had broken repeatedly with Trump and whom the president had marked down as a target for political retribution, clasped arms in the hall with Dan Sullivan, her state's junior senator, recognizing the threat far more seriously than some of her colleagues. "I got my Marine," she said, alluding to Sullivan's status as a colonel in the Marine Corps Reserve. Not far off was Josh Hawley, the Missouri senator and former Supreme Court clerk who had been the first Republican to announce plans to challenge the election results in the Senate. A number of his conservative colleagues thought Hawley's objection was little more than a play for publicity, an act of gratuitous pandering to Trump, who knew little of constitutional law but was always eager to accumulate allies and enablers. As the senators, reporters, staffers, and cops went down an escalator and toward the Senate subway that connects the Capitol to a labyrinth of office buildings, Hawley was no longer gaming out the political impact of his procedural stunt. Nor did he cut the same rabble-rousing pose he had adopted hours earlier, when he was famously photographed holding a clenched left fist in solidarity with onlooking pro-Trump protesters. Now the mob was out of control, and Hawley was simply trying to figure out what had happened and what to do. They just said, "Go to Hart 216, he all but shrugged, naming a spot that would come to be known as the secure location. His Senate colleague, Kevin Cramer, an affable North Dakotan, wondered aloud in his plane's patter about just what was afoot. Cramer had been a trusty Trump ally and, like many Republicans, thought the president's inflammatory behavior was mostly harmless, just the antics of an entertainer-politician. The senator loved telling a story about Trump's priorities from a North Dakota stop the president made on Cramer's behalf. Trump had wanted to know in advance what kind of crowd had Elton John drawn at the Fargo Dome, and could he outdo the English piano man? The last few weeks had been different, though, and Cramer thought Trump had behaved in a grossly irresponsible way in the run-up to January 6th. Cramer had felt the sting of that anger. He had announced a few days earlier that he would vote to certify the election because there were simply no grounds for doing otherwise. The most damaging thing the president has done yet was the way he talked about Pence and his responsibilities, Kramer said. The senators were converging on their secure location, an expansive conference room in the Hart Senate office building, best known as a site of Supreme Court nomination hearings and the explosive testimony of James B. Comey, Jr., the former FBI director, against Trump. And as they approached Hart 216, their predicament began sinking in. Pictures were popping up on their phone showing the rioters pillaging the Capitol, including one man toting a Confederate battle flag just outside the Senate chamber. "Oh, wow," Kramer exclaimed, striding through the Hart basement. "That's right there, all right. How the heck did they get in?" His mind, though, kept returning to the president. "Sometimes I'm not even certain what his end goal is," he said of Trump, adding, "As you know, I'm one of his top loyal people in the Senate. He's never called me. None of his attorneys have called me. Sometimes I wonder if he even really, what the real motive is." 5.5 years after Trump rode down the Trump Tower escalator to announce his campaign for president, his own allies were still wrestling with the same question. Just what is he doing? Mitt Romney knew precisely what his nemesis had done. The former Republican presidential candidate had been one of Trump's harshest Republican critics since the president sailed down that escalator in Trump Tower in June of 2015. Romney had eschewed a third presidential bid of his own that year, opting instead to bombard Trump from the sidelines. After the election, he had attempted a rapprochement with the president-elect, interviewing for the job of Secretary of State over dinner as Jean-Georges in New York, only to be passed over for a former Exxon executive with no government experience. Not long after, Romney had relocated to Utah, the official seat of his Mormon faith, and in 2018 he had taken a Senate seat there. Soon, he became the only Republican senator to vote for Trump's impeachment on the charge of pressuring the Ukrainian government to smear the Biden family. Romney was every bit a politician, and throughout his career, he had displayed a streak of opportunism that was pronounced even by the standards of that profession. But now, in the winter of his political life, he was free to speak his mind about a political figure who offended him to his core. In Mitt Romney's eyes, Donald Trump was a moral atrocity as a man, father, husband, and president. And Romney had never been so visibly and publicly angry as when he strode into Hart 216. Just minutes earlier, he had exited the Senate chamber in fury upon hearing that the Capitol had been breached. He had been directed away from the mob by a fast-acting cop, Eugene Goodman, and by mere seconds, he had escaped colliding with a throng of insurrectionists who would certainly have recognized him on sight. In Hart, Romney would call his home state governor, Spencer Cox, to seek help protecting members of his family in Utah. As he caught up with his colleagues, Romney's eyes were lit with rage, his face flushed. "Unbelievable," he said of what was clearly now a dark day in American history. "This is what the president has caused today, instigating this insurrection," he spat out. It was a national humiliation. "It's what this says to the country and the world," Romney said. "The only time this ever happened before was in the Civil War." Then he stormed off, joining his dazed colleagues in the hangar-sized room as they were phoning aides and relatives to tell them they were, at least for the moment, all right. Others could not avert their gaze from the pictures on their phones. The Senate chamber had been breached. There would be no peaceful transfer of power in America in 2021. This book is an account of a political emergency in the United States, the story of how the country reached and survived a moment when carrying out the basic process of certifying an election became a morally dangerous task. During a period of 2 years stretching from the onset of the coronavirus pandemic through the crucial legislative battles of the new Biden administration, Americans saw their nation's two-party system and the electoral process itself put to an extraordinary test. Not since 1968, a year of political assassinations and mass riots at home, and calamity on the battlefield abroad, has American democracy endured such a period of crisis. In this time, it became inescapably clear that American politics had become not just a contest between parties or factions or regions, or even between the left and the right. the basic elements of American democracy, campaigning and voting and legislating, had been transformed into so many fronts in an existential battle for the survival of the democratic system. Many lawmakers had become mere tribunes for their radicalized constituents, only exacerbating the internal tribalism that was menacing the country more than any foreign foe. The two parties were not merely adversaries, but enemies in a domestic Cold War that had started to run hot. And one of those two parties was enthralled to an authoritarian demagogue who chose to attack the Congress rather than gracefully relinquish power. Well before shots rang out at the Capitol on January 6th, American political leaders were confronting a set of dire questions. In the face of multiple overlapping threats, including a once-in-a-century pandemic, could the basic institutions of American government function? In spite of the country's profound divisions, could the United States still manage to hold a free and fair election and then usher in a new government that would faithfully carry out the people's business? The answer to both questions has been a resounding sort of. Considered from a hopeful angle, the events of this period are indeed an affirmation of American political resilience amid an unheard-of assault from within. The country, after all, did not collapse. A would-be strongman was defeated. The transfer of power from one White House to the next did happen. A new yet familiar president has sought to be a leader for all Americans in a way his predecessor never even feigned. The two parties have negotiated across the aisle in an attempt to improve the lives of their constituents. But that triumphant narrative is not the only important vantage point on this period. Alongside those encouraging events, another timeline has unfolded in dark parallel. Donald Trump has not been banished from national life, but instead remains the dominant force in his party and is bent on purging those few Republicans who won't bow to him. The country's bitter political and social divisions have not eased, but have instead proven so pernicious as to undermine the distribution of miraculous vaccines against the coronavirus, badly worsening the spread of more contagious strains. In contrast to past crises, the pandemic has not united the country, but become a deadly new front in the culture wars. Joe Biden and the Democratic leaders in Congress, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, have only fitfully managed to rally their own ungainly coalition in the job of governing, let alone unite the country as a whole. Far from presiding as a soothing and self-assured national healer, Biden has appeared too often captive to the arcane internal politics of his own party, prone to undermining his own arguments, and too tangled in indecision about his priorities to speak plainly to the country about what they are. And the next election, one that may well return Trump loyalists to power in Congress, is now only months away. The former president's delusions about a stolen election, the fictions that inspired a riot on January 6th, have lingered with corrosive force, warping his own party and catalyzing a wave of red state voting restrictions aimed at cracking down on election fraud that did not happen. The fantasies of a Trump restoration have only deepened since his departure from the White House. In May of 2021, about 4 months after leaving office, Trump telephoned the conservative editor Rich Lowry to tell him his magazine, National Review, would take off like a rocket if it recognized that he had actually won the election. In fact, Trump told Lowry, he expected to be reinstated by August, and Republicans would be put back in charge of the Senate once the supposedly pervasive corruption of the 2020 election was exposed. It was beyond belief, Trump said, that Mitch McConnell did not seem to understand this. The former president's comments were pure madness. As central a figure as Trump is in America's political crisis, however, he is hardly the only consequential character in this period, and his aberrant conduct alone does not illustrate the depth of the country's challenge. Nor was his ascent unique to America. Right-wing nationalism has been menacing liberal democracy around the globe. This is a more complicated, still ongoing story that didn't end with one election. The reporting for this book involved hundreds of interviews with senators, governors, members of the House, diplomats, lawyers, political strategists, entrepreneurs, foreign leaders, and officials at the highest ranks of both the Biden and Trump administrations. It is based on hundreds of pages of confidential documents and recordings of some of the most powerful people in the land, including Trump, Pelosi, Schumer, and McCarthy, speaking in unguarded candor to colleagues and friends. The sources and voices in this story represent a great multiplicity of perspectives that agree on a single reality, that the future of American democracy is at risk. This story unfolds in three parts. First is the pre-election phase, the period in which President Trump was mismanaging the coronavirus pandemic, terrorizing the nation's governors while offering medicine wagon remedies for a catastrophic respiratory plague, and flailing in his efforts to define a message for his own upended campaign. Biden, meanwhile, was laboring to unify the Democratic Party, seeking a running mate and an agenda that could bring together a vast set of constituencies that shared a deep antipathy to Trump and little else. Second is the period stretching from Election Day to the inauguration of President Biden and the second impeachment of former President Trump. In this stage, it was apparent that the country had rejected Trump, but the ultimate balance of power in Washington was very much in doubt. Democrats were contemplating the possibility of Biden's agenda smashing on the rocks of a Republican-controlled Senate, while Republicans were cowering in fear as Trump began to turn on his own party. It took an attack on the Capitol and a second Republican defeat in Georgia to complete the transition away from the Trump presidency. Third, there was the phase from February onward, as President Biden attempted an acrobatic feat of leadership, pushing a liberal policy agenda of titanic ambition with the thinnest of majorities, while reaching across the aisle on other matters to show the country that bipartisan governance was still possible. In this stage, it became grimly apparent that the two-party system remained dangerously unstable. One side, the Republican Party, was collapsing into a faction animated by their disgraced leader and a reflexive contempt for anything associated with the Democrats, including basic public health precautions. Meanwhile, the Biden-led Democrats spent much of 2021 wrestling with their own roiling ideological and cultural divisions, as the coalition that ejected Trump from the White House proved full of challenging contradictions that frustrated Biden's ability to govern. By the end of 2021, Biden had enjoyed one of the most productive first years of any new president, sweeping a multi-trillion-dollar coronavirus relief bill into law, achieving a major bipartisan deal on infrastructure, and coming tantalizingly close to groundbreaking deals on family welfare policy and climate change. Yet those achievements came at a price, as painstaking negotiations strained the cohesion of Biden's party and tested the patience of an electorate detached from the Washington wrangling and increasingly alarmed by the resurgent pandemic and the rising cost of consumer goods. In many respects, Biden's landmark achievements appeared to be the work not of a rising new electoral majority, but of long-entrenched Democratic leaders who came of age in the 1960s and found their last great opportunity to legislate in the present crisis. And as the year wore on, the limitations of those leaders and their mastery of Washington became increasingly clear. Their methods and instincts appeared in many cases painfully mismatched to the merciless politics of 2021. Far from quickly erasing the Trump era, leaders in both parties have found the shadow of the last presidency has been longer and darker than they anticipated, coloring every major political decision and legislative negotiation of the Biden administration and shaping even the perceptions of American democracy overseas. Not long ago, Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut recalled speaking in his office with the Egyptian ambassador to the United States and seeking to lobby him on matters of democratic reform and the human rights of political prisoners. "Look at what's going on in your own country," the envoy had fired back. "You want to preach to us about democracy? I saw what happened on January 6th. Other accounts of this period have emphasized the tactical political decisions that shaped the outcome of the election, or the degree to which unelected elements of the country's government stood up to Donald Trump. During his short presidency, a cult of hero worship sprang up around a succession of non-politicians. Lawmen like Robert S. Mueller III, and physicians such as Anthony Fauci, jurists such as Ruth Bader Ginsburg and John G. Roberts, and military men like James Mattis and, most recently, Mark Milley. But in the end, a democracy can only succeed if its elected leaders are determined to sustain it, and if the voters to whom they answer maintain their faith in the system. As of this writing, it is difficult to say with confidence that either the American elite or the American electorate has what it takes to defend the principles of free and representative government. It is beyond the scope of this narrative to fully catalog the forces that have driven the United States to this baleful point. But even a simple timeline of the last quarter century in American life speaks powerfully to the reasons why many voters may have lost faith in the system. In less than a third of an average American lifetime, the country endured a contested presidential race in 2000. The terror attacks of September 11, 2001, the long and disastrous wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the financial crisis of 2008, and the Great Recession, the election of Donald Trump in 2016, and the devastation of the coronavirus pandemic in 2020. That is a catalog of failure and failure and failure. It is a great irony of this time that it has fallen to Joe Biden, a man implicated in some of those failures, to pull the country back from the brink. In a dark hour, American voters turned not to a messianic outsider or to a man on horseback, but to a man of the gavel, a former Senate committee chairman before he was vice president, to redeem the worn-out system in which he toiled for half a century. Joe Biden did not predict the events of January 6, but the fear of American system failure, of a breakdown in the institutions and values of democracy, haunted him throughout the 2020 election. He felt in his bones that his campaign against Donald Trump was a fight for American survival. On the Sunday before Election Day, he said as much to Hakeem Jeffries, a Brooklyn congressman who joined Biden on the campaign trail outside Philadelphia. Biden was upbeat about his chances, telling Jeffries that he felt good about the energy he was seeing on the trail. He believed he would win on November 3rd. Jeffries agreed. Democrats just needed to keep their foot on the gas through Election Day, he said. It was the sort of small talk, equal parts rah-rah optimism and nervous energy, common at the end of campaigns. Then Biden said something entirely uncommon in American political campaigns, Jeffries recalls. "I certainly hope this works out," the future president said. "If it doesn't, I'm not sure we're going to have a country."